I'll just give a minute. Anybody want to write that down? Because we'll need the page in a minute. I'm the child that's in a Prabhupada key. Is someone want to move it out that way? So, in today's session, we want to spend most of the time in a little discussion on forgiveness, a slight interactive exchange on forgiveness. As we were saying, that one of the causes of depression and that interferes with our devotion is sometimes we hold grudges, we imbibe and hold on to anger. And we understand that a devotee is a dosha darsi, it's not fault finding, and it's not to even be one's enemy's enemy. Sometimes the grudges and the anger and these patterns even started before we joined the Krishna conscious movement. And so as we are not these bodies and we're not these minds, but sometimes the mind and the body still tries to interfere or tries to dominate or tries to make us think that we are aham mamiti. So yesterday we dashed through these states of consciousness. We talked about the jagrat, the waking state, swapana, dream, susupti, deep sleep, chariya, transcendental. We went through that really quickly. We spend most time looking sort of from a Western perspective, the beta, alpha, theta, and delta, emphasizing that at each of these states, certain things is happening in the mind. At each state, that if there's too much involvement at a particular level, it brings complications. If there's not sufficient connection at that level, it can also bring complications. And if there's a healthy integration, then wonderful things happen, and the body is taken care of nicely, the mind, and of course, we have less interference with our Krishna consciousness. So, Bhaktivinoda, mentions in his Shikshamrita what is very necessary to help an individual as well as a community or a society to be successful. And he explains four basic principles. He says, first, there must be a stimulation, healthy stimulation for the mind. That means if we're engaged in devotional activities and if our minds really are not so satisfied, it's going to be problems. But before that, he says there must be healthy care of the body. So again, we're not the bodies, we're not the minds, but if these things are not taken care of properly, there'll be some disturbance. He says, unless one is a Paramahamsa. If you're a Paramahamsa, it doesn't matter. You don't have to worry about anything, about the body, the mind, what you eat, anything. You just depend on Krishna and live on prana if necessary, and that's it. But if we're not Paramahamsas, then these four things are important. Proper stimulation of the mind. The mind is to feel some satisfaction. Proper care of the body. A healthy socialization. The one has good feeling about social welfare that's going on in one's environment. And study of the Shastra. So any community that doesn't emphasize these things sufficiently, it's gonna have a lot of problems. And it'll be somewhat pseudo-community. Any person who is not integrating in all of these areas, there will also be problems, either repress, protracted problems that will come up at different times. Who remember this morning what we read before we chanted our rounds from the Srinamrita about the mind? Anybody remember that little reading, what the essence of it was? This morning, most of us, hopefully everyone was there at the morning program. Is anyone recall? You recall? Yes.
Chanting Hare Krishna helps us to control the wild horses of the mind.
Chanting Hare Krishna helps us to control the wild horses of the mind. Comparing the mind to wild horses, such a way. And yesterday and the day before, we also had some interesting readings about the mind. So, what we want to look at first, and I need to scroll. Was it, Prabhu, there's a marker. Just change to a blank page. We like to brainstorm a little bit, initial few minutes, on what our conception is of forgiveness. I'd like you just to give some ideas and what your understanding is of forgiveness. So we can take a few devotees. What's your understanding, awareness, appreciation is of forgiveness? Just give us some ideas, and we're going to write a few of them down. What your appreciation, what your understanding is of forgiving someone?
Mm-hmm. Not holding a grudge.
Not holding a grudge. Someone else, a few others. What comes to our mind when we think of forgiving someone or being forgiven?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Wishing the best to that person.
Wishing. Got to write fast. Wishing the best. Reestablishment of a relationship. Understanding the person. Not intending, not retaliating. Relief from the heart. He has to learn shorthand, huh? Is he spelling wrong or something? Anyone else? Not retaliating. Also, a relief from the heart. English is not his first language either. He spelled a few things wrong. Anyone else? Yes, just put bringing closure. One or two more. Accepting the person as they are. Mercifulness. Maybe we have room for only one more. Yes. Okay. Moving ahead. Okay, so interesting. Not holding a grudge. GRUDGE. That's a shorthand. Letting things go. Wishing the best. Reestablishment of relationship. Understanding a person. Not retaliating. Relief from the heart. Bringing closure. Accepting person as they are. Mercifulness. And moving ahead. So we see an interesting collage here of things that we think about or that we do when we are able to forgive someone. This is a nice variegated list that we have. Now let's look at, well, let me ask you, what comes to your mind, to your consciousness, when you think about being emotionally hurt? What sort of things come to you? Someone do not physically attack you, but emotionally they've hurt you in some way. Yes, let's flip it over. Yes. Well, let's make it even broader. What comes to your mind when you think about getting hurt? You can put it on any level. Mental, verbal, physical. Yes.
Misunderstanding.
Okay. Misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Betrayal. Number them. 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. No. Broken heart. Broken promises. Okay. Shutting down. Closing down. Anyone else? Okay. Pain. A few more. Retaliation. Okay. So we have a Kshatriya back there. Eight. Yes, someone else? Avoidance. Mm-hmm. Okay. Crying out for help. Yes. Karma. Okay, we have 10 there. Now, our first sheet, perhaps, if we can tear it off and put it on the board. We can see them both simultaneously. Careful. That's passion. Iranian passion. There's a tape under there. Or if you see it, the thumbtacks. Behind you, there's some scotch tape. You may have to use that. So when we look at this list here, it's mostly negative things. Misunderstanding, betrayal, broken heart, broken promises, shutting down, pain, retaliation, avoidance, crying out for help, karma. And then we look at our list here, forgiveness, not holding grudges, letting them go, wishing the best, reestablishment of relation, understanding the person, not retaliating, relief from the heart, bringing closure, accepting the person as they are, mercifulness, moving ahead. Now, let's take this same list here of the hurts. And, well, before that, let me just share something with you. Then we're going to do something with that particular list. We can think of maybe 5 different types of people or situations where we find ourselves being hurt. First, we find that we get hurt by our enemies. Now, that one is not sometimes so bad because we kind of expect that, you know. Someone who seemingly is not having your welfare is their concern, you can expect that that's going to happen. It's not as devastating. We get hurt by our friends. That's a little more intense. Because a friend is somebody who you expect is going to be there for you, and you are supposedly there for them, and you're sharing things in confidence, and you're complimenting each other in various ways. A little more intense is when we get hurt by our families. Like some of us are carrying scars from friends, some from people who may have some issue with us. Hopefully we don't have any enemies. We don't see anybody as an enemy, but somebody may sometimes see us as an enemy and not treat us so nicely. That hurt from the enemy is there, but the hurt from the friend is a little worse. Hurt from perhaps family. Family is supposed to be even more connected with each other to help each other. And then sometimes we hurt ourselves. That's even a little more intense. And as spiritualists, of course, one of our greatest hurts is when we are hurt by our spiritual mentors. When we are hurt by our spiritual authorities, or sometimes we have devotees have been hurt by guru or temple president, temple commander, coordinator, etc. This is obviously considered even worse because the people representing Krishna are there to kind of help us to have confidence in Krishna and in the Shastra, etc. And when they disappoint us, it's very heavy because it can often cause us to lose faith, or, as we were saying yesterday, to lose some of our enthusiasm toward trying to pursue the goal. I teach a course. I have a class at one or two universities in America. I have one course that's being taught on my leadership book. Some of you know I'm writing all different types of books looking at social, psychological issues, and in such a way that they're universal, the way the approach is, but ending with Vedic conclusions. So I have a course at one of the universities that's being taught in America. I taught it the first year, now I have some of my facilitators or disciples teaching. And the course is being taught to people in government, especially some doctors, some people in the American government, in Department of Defense, Department of Treasury, some to teachers, etc. And so one of the things I share in one of our opening sessions, because the course is really to help people to focus more on principle-centeredness and from there go beyond that into spirituality. And I was sharing this with the North American presidents a couple of weeks ago. and our North American meeting presidents and GBCs. And so I was sharing with them that, well, three things we'll share with you as it can help us in this discussion. That when we lose a person, say from our organizations, that it takes about six times as much energy, resources, finances to make a new person as it does to keep a particular individual who is already a part of the society. And this is pretty much standard, whether it's a spiritual group or business or education or whatever. So it takes a lot to keep training up people, recruiting them, training them, and processing them in so many ways. And so to lose a person, it's quite devastating. And when we lose someone, they normally go out and they create havoc or sometimes hell because they're disappointed, they are hurt, they feel offended, and often they're on a campaign. If we look at our own institution, the people who always hurt us the worst, and those who are hurting us the worst at this time, are those who have been a part of us, or those, for instance, our children, or people who've gotten disgruntled who were part of us and now they've joined some other branch or some other institution, or sometimes even our parents, because of how we joined and the way we treated them, or their own understanding of what we do, or their lack of understanding. Even though they're the closest to us, nobody can give us as much trouble as they do. So when we have people who have been a part of us and they leave, nobody can give us as much trouble. Prabhupada says that actually the movement cannot be so much disturbed by any outside influence, ultimately, but by inside. So when somebody leaves, how many people do you think they probably tell about their problem, and how many people you feel they probably talk to in a discouraging way? It's just some maybe guesses. Is 100? Anyone else? That's a whole lot of people. There's not quite that much. But the average person, some people will tell 100, some people will tell 100. Some people will go on a campaign and they'll spend the rest of their life just trying to attack you. But the average person, who is just sort of normal in their anxiety, they tell at least about 10 people. So if you analyze, someone goes out, they influence negatively about 10 people who, in most cases, will not come close or will not join or will be disturbed because of what they hear. Six times as much resources, so you're losing maybe 10 people, and you're losing six times as much finances, resources, input, etc. When people normally leave, just like someone is taking advantage of buying commodities from a firm, or someone is a part of a church or part of an organization, that only about 9% of people really leave because they really find something better. If it's commerce, because they find something cheaper, they find a better deal. Only about 9-10% of people leave because of that. Normally the idea is, well, they've found something better, so they left, or they're just disgruntled, and it's only them. Perhaps, perhaps not. About 15% of people leave because of the fact that they find that they are dissatisfied with the commodity, or dissatisfied with the environment, or whatever. But about 75% of people leave because they do not feel valued. They do not feel cared for. They do not feel that they are being appreciated. They do not see a future for themselves. They do not feel that the vision of the organization, the vision of the business, the vision of the group is including them. So in the final analysis, people really have a need to be needed. People really have a need to be valued and appreciated. Prabhupada told us this right off that if someone leaves, we should see it as these 50% our fault. So the majority of people who do leave our society, they would actually stay if, in fact, they felt sufficiently cared for. And then even if they left, they would leave more in the spirit that I just can't keep up with this practice, and I'm going to be honest, and I'm going to try to work on myself and come back and try to be a better devotee in the future. But when so many people leave with anger and with frustration and become our enemies, then the majority of that has to do with the institution itself, with the environment. Now, of course, we know many, many reasons. People have many, many issues. As we said, it's a karma, it's so many things. But everybody's looking to be loved, to be cared for, looking for shelter, for protection, etc. And if people feel that a situation is pretty much offering that, then they will tolerate it and they will go on. But if not, then they will justify or find more reasons to do something else because of the pain that they're experiencing. So as we work on our relationships, and I think many of the classes are discussing such things, and you see some of you who are going to many of the courses, I think there's certain points that we're mentioning in our various courses that kind of complement each other in various ways about the holy names, so things about consonant. I'm going to get the tapes from the other presenters later, but just from the titles, I would think that we are touching base to a certain extent, or from what you're learning from one class can assist you in what you're learning in another class. So, hurting hearts will never heal until they recognize their pain, their anger, and their helplessness. People who are carrying pain, it makes them sick. It causes them to minimize taking advantage of certain opportunities. And it causes them also to project some of their anxiety, frustrations on others. It has this kind of effect. The negative emotions, they block the healing process, and they surely block our ability to grow in devotional service. Because Krishna explains that one is, of course, dear to him who is not affected by all of these things. One does not become his enemy's enemy. I want to just read two things that Prabhupada gives us, and then we're going to go on a trip. We'd like to take everybody to Vrindavan for a little while. We'll explain that in a minute. Oh, I didn't do this first. I'm jumping the gun. We look at our list, and all of these basically are negative things to a certain extent. Let's look at this same list. These are things that hurt people. These are things that cause some individuals to hold grudges, not to forgive. Now let's just try to transform this into something that's positive. So for instance, take the case of misunderstanding. How can we use that for some type of positive experience or for growth experience? You are dealing with someone, there's some misunderstanding. Yes. Putting ourselves in the position of the other person so that we can try to appreciate why they said or did something. And often this can help to bring clarity. And it can even bring a greater understanding. See, if we take conflicts as just always something negative, we miss the chance for growth. But if we see conflicts that they're often an outgrowth of diversity, conflicts are a chance to clarify perceptions. Conflicts can be seen as a chance to clarify needs, to look closer at social systems or whatever to see how they're working. And for devotees especially, conflicts gives us a chance to see how to serve better. So where there's misunderstanding, we can turn that into a chance to look closer at what one is experiencing, feeling. When we're dealing from a model of love, when someone who you love is not understanding you, then you look at this and you think, how can I assist my beloved so that he or she is not feeling this way, does not miscue what I said, or how can I act differently so that person will not be disturbed? Betrayal. How can we turn that into something? Someone seemingly has betrayed us. How can we use that for growth? Yes.
Develop humility.
You can develop humility. Instead of immediately feeling that it's the other person's fault, we can look at, again, the role that we played, or we can look closer at what we did that caused the individual to act in that way. Not we can learn from that, and from how we feel when someone betrays us, we can then think about what happens when we betray others, and so then we'll be more careful not to inflict that same pain on someone else. A broken heart, that's pretty similar. Let's go down to retaliation. How can we turn that into something positive? Retaliation means someone says something or does something to you, and then you do something back to them. Somebody speaks harsh to you, and you speak back. Somebody gives you a smack, and you give them a knock. You give them two, they give you one. How can we change? Yes? By serving them? Uh-huh. One more. Not coming down to the same level. Sometimes people are in our life just to help us in looking at ourselves, or people in our lives to help us to work certain things that we need to work on. People in our lives sometimes to help us to be more tolerant, to be more aware. And so their approach is a chance for growth, or we can come down to the same level and then miss a chance to pass our particular tests. And number eight, avoidance. How can we turn that into something positive? Often when we have troubles with someone, we just want to be out of their mind, out of their sight. We don't want to see them. We don't want to hear about them. I've seen people, one Gurukuli disciple I have, her and her mother had such a grudge toward each other, or her toward the mother. They lived in the same house. They didn't speak to each other for about 9 years. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Avoidance, how can we? Mm-hmm. Yes, just go to the person and address the issue. So, this is quite interesting, and we'll stop there. The others we can look at in different ways. But you can see that anything that happens in our life that causes us to hate the person or to retaliate or not to forgive, we can take same things, perceive them differently, and we can use it in a way that's positive. It's like some people have issues in their lives, as we talked about, being abandoned or feeling a sense of abandonment. So you can turn that also into a chance to become more independent, a chance to for self-actualization, a chance to be more creative, etc. Or we can be seen that someone disowned us or wasn't there for us or pushed us out when we should have been taken care of. But everything has to do with attitude and perception, which means consciousness. Because a devotee is supposed to be free of the duality, then a devotee has to gradually learn how, not to be affected by such things. The more that we are affected by the duality, the more we are guaranteeing ourselves to take another material body. Because material body in material world means constant, transitorial, relative things. As we are becoming not in denial, but less affected by such, then it means that we're no longer of the quality of this material environment. That we are preparing ourselves to go eternally, to be a part of the realm of eternal love and eternal association with extended, ultimate, you see, knowledge. So these things, it's a gradual process. And often we fail. See, forgiveness is not repressing anger, but it's really transforming the anger. Like transforming the lust into love. Transforming the fear and the anger into helping, into understanding. Sometimes in trying to forgive someone, it can be as painful or even more painful than the experience that you had with that person, the attack or the abuse or whatever the person did that caused you a disturbance. Sometimes trying to forgive them is even more painful than that experience. But as we genuinely try to forgive, it releases us from the duality. It causes us to be able now to have more focus on devotion, on love. It causes us to be able to dive deeper into the culture of bhakti. And it also acts as a way to serve that person. Because as you do the right thing, then you're sending a message to the person who did something improper, and we grow through, of course, serving each other. We want to see if there's time, if we move swiftly, that we can share some experiences in our lives of times that we were hurt, and we were able somehow to change that, to transform that, to use that for growth, or to get certain understanding from that. And so if time allows us, we'll try to do that the last few minutes. But we want to do one or two other things before we take a little trip to Vrindavan. Well, first, maybe as a catalyst, I'll share experience with you. I'm the youngest in my family. One brother and so many girls, many sisters. So I'm spoiled and the baby of the family, etc. I had an interesting relationship with my father. My father just died a few years ago. He died, he was in his 90s. He's a very strong, healthy person. Most of his life, the last maybe 6 months, a year, and the body just sort of just deteriorated almost like overnight. But he was an interesting person. We want to take that with us about gratitude. If we can just use more of the mind in focusing on such, then it will have its way of stimulating the body and the consciousness, and it will draw more success. When we have a mindset of impoverishment and anger and frustration and whatnot, we will find ourselves drawing more of that around us. So as we are accepting and appreciating what things Krishna has done in our lives, and not looking so much at what we don't have. Some people have a tendency of constantly looking at what they do not have, and they'll find themselves constantly in an impoverished state. So our discussion today, which looks at the mind, states of consciousness, can help us to focus in a little bit more about the dynamics of this thing called mind and what it does, what it can do, the influence that it has on ourselves and on the environment. In the Vedic culture, we have these four states: Jagrat, Swapana, Susupti, and Turiya. And you can see the meanings. Jagrat is the waking state. It should be Swapana. It's been a P-A-N-A. The dream state. Susupti, deep sleep. And Turiya, the transcendental state. That means we have this body, and within this body, there are constant different flows of consciousness. And there are many gradations, and many things is happening in between these particular states. Many people sleep 10 hours, 12 hours a day, 6 hours, 8 hours, etc. So, for instance, a person sleeping the average 8 hours. Basically, the average body needs about 8 hours of sleep. We say 6 hours because if we're chanting good rounds for 2 hours, it has a way to replenish the body. So you take those 2 hours, those 6 hours, you have 8 hours. Basically, the body needs about eight. So, but if you think the average about 8 hours, that means 1/3 of people's lives are in sleep. So it's pretty important what is going on with all that time of our lives. And a lot of what happens, of course, in sleep has a lot to do with what's been processed during the waking state. And even more so, so many things we do in the waking state has already been formulated, stimulated in the dream state. And then we act upon it, sometimes consciously, but most times unconsciously. So, Jagrat, the waking state, and I'm going to turn to look at this a little closer from Western psychology, cosmology, as we try to really hone in to ways of how to control our mind better, be more sensitive to what's going on in our minds, and to be able to be a little more careful about avoiding things that are unhealthy. Now, the Western state doesn't include Turiya. They know nothing about transcendence. But they have their own four categories. And the two of the categories would fit within here. If I turn, you'll see a little better. First state we have is called Veda. And this is the waking or the conscious state. Now, as we look at these, we're going to discuss, we'll define it a little bit, tell you about some of the benefits, and then we'll tell you some of the downside that's connected with each of these states. As in the last, say, 20, 30 years, there's been more and more investigation on what is called biofeedback, where biorhythms, where the mind is looked at very closely, what happens, what's going on when you're frightened, what's going on in the mind when you feel peaceful, what's happening when you're in slight sleep, when you're in deep sleep, what's happening when a person is able to, like a yogi, really go into deep, deep states of altered states of awareness. And so there are certain things that happens to the body, to the environment, as things are going on in the mind. So now in the beta state, you better put my glasses on. It is the rather what we normally call full or active alert consciousness. And obviously what happens from this state is that one is very aware of what is going on in the physical environment. Now, some of the imbalances, if too much focus, the mind settles in this level too often without experiencing some of the other states, is that one will be extremely meticulous, very precise to a point that it's picayune, that often it brings sort of a lack of emotions and compassion. This is a matter of regimentation, a matter of preciseness. So some people who do not experience a fluctuation of these other states, they will have this type of personality. And it can be somewhat obnoxious. The next state is called the alpha. And the alpha state is like a slight hypnotic state. It's a state of sort of daydreaming. It's like some of you are a little tired. And so you're hearing, but the conscience is not so sharp. Or you're alert, but you're thinking about something else. And so you're here in the room, but you've kind of flicked away to what you took for breakfast or what you're going to have tonight, etc., what's going on at your temple. For a minute, you were kind of not fully present. But you were present, but you weren't fully present. So you weren't asleep, but you weren't fully alert. So this is like a slight meditative state. Now, what happens at this level when we are too much at this level? It brings dullness. It causes one to be somewhat, confused or uncoordinated. It brings about forgetfulness. When one of the ways to understand this state, and I alluded to a little earlier, I think the first day, when people normally watch television, movies and other things like that, where your senses are sort of glued in to action that's happening, that's like an alpha state. Now, the danger in this state is that one becomes about four times more susceptible to whatever stimulation is there. And you can understand that, you know, when you're the average person watching television, sitting on their comfortable chair, couch, and they're eating something and watching. And so, because there's movement also, they're hearing, they're looking, and they're kind of zapped in. And so sometimes you call them, you have to call them twice, you have to touch them or whatever. But they're there, but they're not fully present. So the danger at this state is that whatever is coming across, it will impinge upon you four times more than if you were just seeing this in the room or if you were dealing with somebody outside and this is going on. Now see the danger in that. For instance, in America, by the time a child is 18 years old, that kid has already seen something like about 400,000 violent crimes and about 50,000 murders. And so that means it's diet, violence, promiscuousness, so much. And now there, people are letting these things come into their living rooms. Even ourselves as devotees, we're letting things come into our house that we would never physically invite. But we turn that television on and these things come, so not only are we inviting them, but they're coming on us four times more than it would if there was just someone acting like that in our particular living room. Because the mind is somewhat not in the beta, but it's a little tuned to the alpha, it's down, and so there's more input in that sense. Accelerated learning. There's different techniques for accelerated learning, where people can learn, can remember many things, can learn languages in a short time. People are trained, you know, how to do all kind of astounding feats. And one of the ways this is done is through Baroque music and putting people in sort of an alpha state. Because it means that some of your guards are down, and now what is coming, is coming, and you can learn, you know, 10 times, 20 times more than you could in a normal setting. And it's been proven that there are people who teach these sort of accelerated learning techniques. The Baroque music has its way that it's, you know, it's pronounced the same beat as the heart, and it has some way of intruding into the mind. Similar to what happens with some of the mind control things, is that people have sometimes studied the mind to a point that they realize the mind is like a machine. There are different ways how you can control it, you can use it. This is where we're saying how some people are traumatized and they're used for espionage. In very high level circles, there are people who are groomed through incest, and they're groomed through a lot of torturing, and so they have many different personalities, at least 3 or 4 personalities. And so there are ways how to tune that person to a certain personality where they can give a message through espionage to someone. Many people are like sex slaves. They have sex, they give a message, and then they forget, they're toned off where they are not even aware of what has happened, but they're controlled by people who know about this sort of mind control. This is going on now all over the world, especially in the modern countries. Or as you mentioned yesterday, sometimes a person has a mental challenge or schizophrenia, and it's because of some serious trauma they've had in their lives, and they have just shut down a certain personality, or they develop a certain personality to defend against that particular trauma. The alpha state brings a lot of forgetfulness, but even more so is the theta state. Now, theta, keep in mind we're going from alert to practically unconscious, not being aware, but still being alive, obviously. So the theta state is light sleep, where the alpha is more like a slight meditation, a little distraction from what is going on, restfulness, etc., where you're very relaxed. So the theta state is like deep sleep or deep meditation, deep hypnosis. The good part about the theta state is that it can bring out one's creative tendencies. A lot of, you know, higher perceptions and things. People meditate a lot or are able to go into deeper states of awareness, of sort of like trance. Artificial ways of inducing this is like through drugs and alcohol. And being in that state too much can cause a lot of anger, bad temper. And this is a state also that can bring particularly mental illness and possession. Because it's at this state, for instance, people who often are alcoholics or take drugs, their subtle body gets affected. It's like their subtle body has holes in it, like the aura, the astral body. And so it makes themselves more susceptible to certain intrusions from disembodied beings, entities. This is why sometimes there are people like New Agers and other people who sometimes do a lot of meditating and they're weird. Or they got all kind of things around them. Those who may be a little sensitive. You find some of these people, they have all kind of energies, all kind of consciousness around them, because they have drawn that by entering into these states and not being aware or not protecting themselves. Or why sometimes devotees who come into Krishna consciousness but who break principles, they get possessed. They come into the process and they break principles and they go crazy, they go batty. Because they have been engaged in altering their awareness. They've tuned in to certain levels of consciousness without being able to distinguish or to block what might come. Just as there is, you know, there are so many higher entities that are agents of the Lord, and there are so many lower beings. If we look at the idea of asura and asura, we see that that the demons, they also have many different types of cities and abilities. But they are so much conscientiously working against the Lord and the devotees. And we see that there are also various types of devotees and helpers and yogis who are not necessarily in the physical, but who also are there to help. So when you start opening up these kind of doors, even though you're a devotee, but if you're not being an honest devotee, then it's like going out on the battlefield with your armor, I'm sorry, with your uniform, but without your armor. So one becomes a very vivid, candidate to be attacked. So this is serious, because we have too many people who are engaged in devotion who become casualties. It has a lot to do with, first, with how much we really want to know Krishna. Prabhupada said that most of the disciples want to go to the heavenly planets. So that means the real essence of many people's devotion is that they don't really, really want Krishna. And so therefore, certain challenges will automatically put them away or put them at a distance, or they will justify deviating or justify leaving the process, or they will justify taking to a lower standard, because in the inner part of their consciousness is that they don't really want to fully surrender to Krishna anyway. And so then they allow this as a justification for not going deeper. And we should expect to see more and more of this, and we should understand that this is and will inevitably happen. Because all types of people are brought into the devotional environment, especially by Lord Caitanya and Lord Nityananda's mercy. And so if there is too much doubt, fear, too much interest in materialism, then there will be certain things that will then categorize us, will put us in certain categories due to the fact that this is where our consciousness is, and Krishna is arranging through Maya to qualify us. So this delta state, as we engage in these things, just like when we are chanting, and we're chanting with a lack of attention, the mind is getting altered. It's going from the beta. We're chanting the holy name. We're looking at a picture of the Lord. We're chanting, and we're going off into, because we're tired, or we're thinking about so many other things. So this can be dangerous, because this fluctuates back from the theta and the alpha, and it can cause forgetfulness. It can cause one to begin to experience a certain amount of anger or restlessness. We find that so many places in the world, devotees are having accidents. Most cases due to not proper sleep or attention. But in sleep, etc. But in other cases, it's due to the fact that devotees have been chanting so long in an improper way that their consciousness is constantly shifting and they're not sufficiently alert. And so while they're driving, then their consciousness is shifting from time to time and can cause accident. Some of you will probably notice that since you've become a devotee, your memory has gotten worse. Of course, it's probably due to age also. To get older. But some are not so old. Some of you are not like half a century like some of us are, or more. And your memory is so bad, where it was a lot sharper before. And it can have something to do with too much entering into this particular state. It creates a kind of a, you can become spacey. And hopefully none of us in the room have been into a lot of deviation, because if so, it is very dangerous. When you take initiation and you are trying to follow these things somewhat, and then you decide not to follow it, how many times have you seen people, at some point, they just go bad, they go berserk? Because they've opened themselves up without protection. They have tuned in, they've altered the consciousness, and at the same time, they're not being aware. They're not really aware of what this really means. The last state is called the delta. And this is full sleep, a deep sleep. Now, this state is very necessary because it heals the body. Just like some of us have come in here, some are coming from a different time zone. So it's just awesome that at 10 o'clock it's still light here. Unbelievable. You know, you kind of get in the habit that when it gets dark, you start knowing it's time to take rest soon. And here it's light, 10, 11 o'clock. Unbelievable. The buddy was telling me a little while ago, you can play soccer here at 10, 15. So then it may be some difficulty in the body getting deep rest. Or something is on your mind. Or sometimes people have a little insomnia or have heavy insomnia. So in such cases, there'll be trouble in one being able to get deep sleep. So even though you may sleep 6 or 7 hours, but if you weren't getting deep sleep, the body will not be getting sufficiently rejuvenated. And therefore, the immune system is weaker and you're more susceptible to, you know, various types of diseases and other things. And so at this state, it helps to heal the body. I've been talking to a few devotees who have some chronic illness. I was talking to one devotee in Vrindavan who has a very serious problem, and he went there literally to die. But he's still hanging on. But he was mentioning how the doctors told him that if he would have been getting proper rest, that 50-60% of his problem would have never existed. And so the body being a machine, as we rest, naturally the cells, the tissues, they get repaired. It does its work. But now, too much of this delta, we know what that produces, huh? See, people who just sleep, huh? They're dull, they're dry, and they're often even more depressed. Sometimes that's a sign of depression also. So too much of that can zap you out, that you won't be alert, or you won't be creative, or you won't be able to function between the alpha state that sometimes is very healthy, be able to tune down. So the average healthy person is constantly fluctuating for all of these states. Any one too much causes a problem. Sometimes people have insomnia because they're too much on the beta platform. And so even when they go to take rest, the mind is just going like anything. They just lay there. Huh? Some of you know what that's like, huh? You lay there for hours. Everybody's sleeping and snoring around you, and you're thinking, damn, why can't I go to sleep? And you're just having such trouble. Huh? And you look at your watch, and it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and finally you finally go off to sleep. Too much beta. And where there is too much alpha, you say we get forgetfulness, alpha and theta, and even perhaps even some type of possession. And data, that level of ignorance is too much of that. One just might as well practically give up the body because it's like being a ghost. So these are just some things to reflect on as we chant and focus that the mind can be our greatest enemy or our greatest friend. We become more sensitive about what we are feeling. We find ourselves not feeling enthused. We should realize that something is happening and some things are going to connect based on what is going on in our particular consciousness. That we'll be more likely to get sick. We will be more likely for accidents, forgetfulness, so many different things. So the body is being influenced by the mind, and the mind and body itself can interfere from the natural expressions of the soul. We're not so much in the body or mind consciousness, but we do want to access our original identity. And that comes by at least not letting these things interfere so much. So we want to talk a little bit, and then we'll take a few questions. We'd ask you the day before about mentioning times that you felt most that Krishna had abandoned you. Now we want to look at kind of the other side and look at our devotional career so far. And reflect on time in your life when you felt most enthused in your devotional service. And what was going on in your mind at that time? You know, what was going on with you? And then you look a little bit about what was happening in the environment. Now, the reason we bring up such things is one, for us to see what sort of situations influence us in what ways. Also, so that we can look a little closer how to produce those higher realizations, good times, experiences. It's like when people are trained up in, sometimes people are in chronic pain, or athletes are trained up in biofeedback. They're just trained up in how, on their own, to alter their state of consciousness at will. By first knowing how each state feels. Just like, for instance, if you are visualizing, you know, a lion or a tiger about to jump on you, then the body will experience something because the mind will pick up in a certain way. You just try to visualize, you know, walking near a river and it's very beautiful and the nice lotus flowers are there and things are smelling very nice. Just by just thinking like that for a while, the mind will get altered into a certain way. And so if we are stressful so much, or accepting stress, then things happening to the body based on what we're thinking about, how we are perceiving, how we are codifying something determines then what we experience. So in Kali Yuga, where literally things do get worse, we don't want to be in Kali Yuga. We want to create a higher age, a higher consciousness, even though this is a lower age. We want to create higher realizations, even though all kind of hell may be happening around us. Otherwise, the basic karma of most countries in this planet is not so wonderful. Just the killing of the cows is enough to destroy present-day human civilization. So we don't want to be of this world, or to be in the world but not of it. And the way we do that is that we have to be able to alter consciousness more. And this is why Krishna emphatically explains to Arjuna, Nishtre Gunya Bhava Arjuna, rise above the modes. And he tells Arjuna how one who is dear to him, one is unaffected by the modes. And he explains, one does not see themselves as a proprietor, they're not envious, they're not affected by happiness or distress. Means that even though so much is going on and happening around them, they're not playing into it. They're being able to alter or to maintain a certain awareness in spite of whatever is there. One of the reasons people become more and more bombarded and absorbed in depression is because they are either too attached to some issues and get overly worked up. They carry too much lack of self-esteem or abandonment. They minimize so much what they do have and just think about what they do not have. And they play so much into lower patterns which they perceive and codify in such a way that they accept it. And then become a part of that. So there'll be this tremendous increase in people with mental challenges and depression because that will be the increased atmosphere. And so few people will be able to not be affected by what is generally present. But as sadhus, we have a duty to try to keep in touch with transcendence. As we're on a mission, we're passing through. So this little discourse of states of consciousness just to help us to think a little more that the mind is very powerful. It plays many, many games. It atones itself to many, many levels. And we all have within us the ability of what we're going to accept and what we're going to tune into. Somebody can say something to you very harsh. And you can accept it and get very angry and respond based on that. Or you can just feel sorry for the person that the person is saying such a thing. Or you can just look at it and think, well, let me see what I'm doing that makes this person react and speak like this. So the same thing is said, but it's codified, perceived in a different way. You act in a different way, and you get different things happening to you, and it happens to the environment. This is not being in denial, but it's a matter of just not playing in to level of nonsense. So, maybe before we take our sharings, anyone has any questions on the little things we just went over just now? So, please.
I was raised in devotional life being stressed out, you know, especially doing management. I had an experience of last year, my memory just went. You know, just disappeared from, I think it was stress. And I was wondering, where does the stress come in and how does it affect you? How do you go through everything?
The stress can come from a lack of something. Stress can come from a lack of delta, a lack of deep rest. So then it's affecting the body, which is then affecting the mind. Stress can come from too much activity on the beta platform. In your case, it seems probably more from that, because you're thinking a lot about, you know, the externals, about management, about issues and things. And so much of that, the mind isn't getting a chance to relax. The body isn't getting a chance to relax. And so it's just hyper in that way. See, stress is good. It's like spice. A certain amount of stress motivates us, causes us to do many wonderful things, many creative things. A certain amount of spice is very good. But too much of it, it spoils the food. So too much stress just begins to break down one's entire mental and physical being. Any other question? Yes.
You change your rounds often. In what state you are, and how deep is it going to work inside of your mind?
If you are chanting with attention, then this will have effect on your physical body, because it's giving you more rest, and it's allowing you to be less affected by so much of the bombardment of material energy. And because we're calling Krishna's name, I mean, we are calling on the Lord's name. So it means we're calling with less static, less stuff that's interfering. And so then we tune in more to transcendence. And, we know the 10 offenses. This is just another sideline, it's secondary. But we know the 10 offenses, what happens when we do not chant properly.
And on the alpha state, if you watch television, it works like 4 times deeper in your unconsciousness. So if you chant on the alpha state.
So if you are chanting too much in the alpha state, then this is not to make anybody think that, well, if you're not going to chant with attention, don't chant at all. Because we're still depositing eternally in our bank account. But at the same time, we're making other types of deposits. And we'll get certain influences from that. So the best thing is that sometimes we find that we just can't chant with attention. There's too many things on our mind. Or some emergencies are there. Or some things that are really significant that we have to deal with. But we shouldn't get in the habit that's the way that we do our chanting. For many people now, this is the way they do their chanting. This is the way they do their sadhana. It's always on the run. And then no wonder why, you know, they're not feeling more enthused in the process. Why they're not making more advancement. Yes?
Maharaj, you mentioned that Krishna, our material energy, is classifying devotees according to the consciousness.
Yes, I say how material energy is qualifying devotees. In other words, just take people in general. Somebody on the planet doesn't want to know about the Lord at all. So Krishna, Sarvashaham Sanivisto, Krishna in the heart is arranging for Maya to facilitate that person. So they're atheists. Someone wants to know Krishna, you know, 20-30%. So they get attracted to a certain religious process that will give them that amount of exposure and opportunity. Now, someone has come through those 4 different ways, Shatuvaha, Vajangtemam, and they are saying yes. And so they came out of distress, they came out of wealth, out of pursuit for wealth, curiosity, or knowledge. Now, even within that, there are different levels of consciousness. And so someone really wants to be the servant of the servant. And whatever it takes, they want to go back to Godhead in his lifetime. So Krishna is going to arrange certain things that will be in their life space, that they'll experience. Someone else doesn't really want that level of commitment. They're more like in the mood of the demigods, some of the demigods. Well, they know Krishna, but they want their turf. And so there's a certain allegiance and reverence toward the Lord, rituals, etc. But there is still some lording over tendency. There is still some ha-mameti kind of mindset. So Krishna arranges to allow Maya to facilitate them. And so for people like that, they'll be various disturbances, challenges that will bring them out of the ongoing royal path of devotion, because they are not really wanting to go directly back to Godhead, and so they will settle in. So when we see people settle in at different levels, we really shouldn't be that shocked. Otherwise, if it's just an arbitrary thing that's just happening somehow, just by chance, then why are we even worshiping Krishna? If Krishna is not really watching things, is not really dealing with people according to their genuine character, then why are we worshiping this God, who is really out of control? But it's a fact that he is in control. And so every single person is having some things going on in their lives based on karma and based on their desires. There's something about our desire that brings various things happening to us. It doesn't happen always, doesn't unfold always in the exact way that we expect. It's like when you order a meal at a restaurant downstairs, so you ask for a particular thing, but when it came, you ate it and you didn't like it. And you call out the devotee, I didn't ask for this. The devotee said, this is what you ordered, this is what you paid for. But you said, no, I didn't want this. What you mean is that I didn't like the way it tasted. But the order was put in, and something was served to you. So many times what comes to us, we're not comfortable with. But there's something about our mentality, our consciousness, that draws.
Are there questions picking up? Or I should repeat. It's okay.
How do we change our desires to ones that are more favorable for attaining Krishna consciousness?
By our association. As I said, it's very rare for most people to just keep on being very strong without a good association. When we have so many people who we're associating with who are faithless, inevitably we're going to find ourselves feeling faithless. We're associating with so many people who are engaged in prajalpa, inevitably we're going to find ourselves somewhat being influenced. Even if we're stronger than them, in most cases we'll find ourselves also being influenced. So a devotee is to look for higher association as much as possible. See, that's why there's a general wave of doubt and faithlessness, because there's so many people who are faithless, and so what happens is it spills over. Now, it's not necessarily their fault. They're faithless because of so many things that's happening around them that's not supportive. Or so many things happening around them to make them feel that they're not valued. So many things that's happening around them to make them question about the sort of social, political, economic structure of the movement, etc. Anyone else?
Talking about those states of consciousness, I was thinking, you said that in authentic chanting shouldn't be something that you just say, you know, I'm chanting like this and that's all. But if there is a reason why someone keeps chanting authentically, like there are some fears of which you're afraid of, I don't know, something, is it useful to maybe get like in one of the states, like in the alpha stage, maybe when you're more susceptible to some things, so maybe you get hypnotized or something, and you get to know what the problem is, and then you can chant properly and remove those fears, or you chant, you keep chanting, and the chanting will remove those fears. So is there any of these states of mind that can actually help in devotional service to overcome something so you can perform devotional service better?
There are many different techniques that can affect the physical and the subtle body that we don't have to be so much concerned with. But we should realize, see, the one reason we're doing this is to help us to see that what the acharyas and what Prabhupada has given us is always very scientific. They don't have to explain all the little details about every little aspect. Why? They're transcendentalists. We don't have to go through all of the dynamics of what happens when you chant. But we understand that we're calling on Krishna's name as we genuinely have the desire to know him, then he will remove certain obstacles. Being more aware of how powerful it is can help us to be a little more careful about not doing the wrong thing, so that we try to do the right thing, and most importantly, we try to develop more of a genuine consciousness. Ultimately, Krishna consciousness is never just about technique. We can even follow all the rules and regulations and not go back to Godhead. Krishna is not a karma conduct thing. It's not that Krishna can be just purchased just by ritual or by austerities or by sadhana. But these things done give us the foundation for developing the proper consciousness. If we don't do them, there's no question of going back to Godhead. But if we do them and we have the proper service attitude and the proper consciousness, then that is what attracts Krishna. Now, there are people who, through therapy and different types of therapy, can be helped. We mentioned the very first day that of all the different systems of therapy, it is not that one distinctly works better than another. But what variable is definitely distinct is that when the relationship between the therapist and the patient is good, then a person gets helped. So that means a lot of mental challenges have to do with the person literally feeling cared for, feeling helped, feeling encouraged, and then the mind works on itself and helps itself in such ways. One of the dangers in hypnosis, I did hypnotherapy at Princeton as part of a dissertation. In those days we had to do dissertations even in early parts of our study. And I was bored, so I was trying to think of something to do, something spiritual and something a little different. So I did work in what's called a regression research, where you hypnotize people and you take them back to earlier time in their life or into back to another lifetime. And so I saw it firsthand, and later I was able to read and understand more about it. But there were some of my classmates who could go into very, very deep states when you hypnotize them. Again, people's consciousness is different. And could experience past life experiences and etc. But the danger is that we would just be in the dorm or be in class, and just my speaking would influence them, even when they're in the beta state, even though they're just in the waking state. They're not under any hypnotic influence. So what can happen is that when someone hypnotizes you, some of their consciousness, some of their energy enters into your mind, and it can linger on. And so it's a little dangerous. Although hypnosis, for someone you really trust, and is a devotee, and for some reason you want to have that kind of therapy, the best thing is to have someone train you how to do self-hypnosis. And then you can be able to reflect. Because it's just that there's a physical body. Every time we die or leave the body, the subtle body takes the soul onto another body. So many impressions from other lifetimes are within the subtle body. So there are some ways how to kind of touch into the subtle body. And so for some people, as they go, particularly back in earlier times in this life, certain traumas, certain issues in their lives, as they have chance to sort of work with them or work through them, then sometimes it can remove blocks. But it should be done very conscientiously if one wants to pursue that kind of therapy. Not ultimately necessary, because as we chant with more and more purity, we do become aware of our previous lives, become aware of so many things. As we become more freer of the gross covering, then we become aware of so many things. We begin to experience so many things. Our concern is how to be better servants and not necessarily the experience. But Krishna consciousness works if we honor it. If we go on year after year, the same state of consciousness, it means we're cheating somehow. It means that there's some things that we're doing that's not allowing the science to develop properly. We shouldn't even have the same consciousness we had 2 years ago. We should be becoming more Krishna conscious, even though we may be having more economic issues, other issues. But our desire to become Krishna conscious should be stronger, and our realization should be getting stronger. And if not, then it means we're not having strong enough healthy association, or we're playing too much into prajalpa, or into fear, or into the general currents. And because of that, then there is some stagnations. See, if Maya is getting stronger, and we're not also getting stronger, then what does that mean? If Maya is getting stronger, if we're not getting stronger, then that Maya, as it is getting stronger, is attacking us harder and we're getting weaker. Any other questions? So this is why enthusiasm is, again, important, because with enthusiasm, then it acts as a barometer that when you find that you're not enthused, then it's like an alarm to look a little closer, try to see what is the issue, you know, that's on the table. But many people, they are experiencing those states of lack of enthusiasm. They're in concealment or in denial, or they scapegoat, and the problem gets worse. It's like a cancer. Or we're associating with somebody, and we definitely see that they're losing it. They're not chanting their rounds. They're not hearing the class. They're getting more and more caught up again in some of their past habits and patterns. And sometimes we just let that person go down, 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 until they bite the dust. And then we say, oh, just look, just see. We have a responsibility to each other to try to assist in various ways.
Should I take a mic?
No, you have a question.
Yes.
Just speak.
You just
gotta speak loud. We'll take it. I can hear you in the back.
You're just mentioning how, when you just said it, we want to be our brothers and sisters' keeper. But we also hear that, we shouldn't be in a critical mood, we shouldn't criticize others, we shouldn't point out faults. You know, the example is given that, you know, when you're a sieve, you're full of holes, and you start pointing out to others who maybe have, you know, maybe like needles. Or the devotees are like a moon, and, you know, the moon has some spots on it, but, you know, you don't point them out. But then on the other hand, if you really care about someone, then, and you see they're doing something wrong, you want to help. But sometimes, personally, we read that we're not in any position to point out someone else's faults, in that sense. So how do we resolve
it? Yeah, the devotee is Adosha Darshi, is not into fault finding, but we're into love searching. In other words, we want to constantly see how we can serve. And love does involve monitoring. Love involves being accountable and trying to help others to be accountable. You don't, you know, engage or denial. But it means, you know, that there is certain boundaries and certain things that we hold ourselves accountable for and we hold others accountable for. And there is some bundle, there's a good relationship. We're just looking to find something so we can feel that we're better than that person or find a way to attack that individual. Then that's unfortunate. Or if we are engaged in any type of Vaishnava aparas. See, this depositing in a bank account is very powerful. But one of the things that really kind of takes some of the credits away is Vaishnava aparas. You look at most cases where there is a big fall down, and you study close and you see aparas, then the immune system gets weak. Then one falls down to things that normally they wouldn't be so disturbed by. Like was it Sobari Muni, that by offending Garuda, then his environment that normally he was not disturbed by, then he falls down by seeing two fish engaged in copulation. But previously he was meditating in the water. There's no problem. So when we make these offenses, the consciousness gets altered in so many ways because of the offenses, and we open up. We get open up for being devastated. It's a science. We just have to really appreciate how Prabhupada has given us something extremely wonderful. And now we just want to study it closer to make it work. I had an interesting experience, I guess last year, when I was in UK, giving one Bhagavad Gita class. And one senior devotee, excuse me, any of those of you from UK, one senior devotee mentioned about that we have done so much austerity, renunciation, and following Shastra and so many things, and we've been so extreme. So now if we go to the other side, and if we, you know, minimize things and do this, it's okay because, you know, it'll create a balance. And I thought he was joking at first. He's saying that we were so like this, and now it's okay, we should go to the other extreme because that will help to create, you know, some type of medium, you know, in the near future. But my point was, it's not that we've been extreme, it's just that now we have to really follow what really is there. In some cases we were following the facade and not the real spirit. Or we're doing things without accessing the essence. So we want to be more careful about following and following the essence. Not that we have to throw things out, but we have to do, in most cases, we have to do things in the proper essence. And where we do have to change, then it's a matter of changing details. The essence should not be changed. There are certain things distinctly that worked in the early 60s, early 70s that do not or will not work now. There are certain things when we were 19, 20, 22 years old that were extremely relevant that will not have the same appeal now that we're 45, 50 years old. It's like when a person is 2, 3, 5 years old, there's certain things they do, and you say, oh, the little girl is so cute. She does that same thing and she's 20, 30 years old, and you say, this is nonsense, child, nonsense woman. Huh? Same act. So, you know, we're not, you know, even 20, 25, we're older now. We're surely not 5 years old. So there's certain things that we should have more in place because of that. I'll take one or two more questions. So what I'm going to do tomorrow I wanted to start off with a forgiveness workshop. Because so often, some of our blocks in Krishna consciousness, and even just in being, you know, healthy persons, is due to anger and due to issues that have happened in our life as devotees, or even before we joined devotional service, that we haven't released, we haven't forgiven ourselves, we haven't forgiven others. So we wanted to do some interactive things, forgiveness workshop. And it may mean that we have maybe half the room stay here and half the room on the grass according to what the weather is like. But what we'll do is we'll take the first 15 minutes or so, and we just like to discuss time that you were most happy in your devotional service and what was going on in your mind. Because by doing this, some of us can kind of grab, we're not just looking in the past. Some people live in the past, you know. There's always issues, there's always things. But we have to be in the present and the future. But there are certain things that have happened to us, and we begin to focus more on those, we can bring back some of that strength. We can bring back realizations. We can bring back understandings. We can bring back states of consciousness based on remembering how it felt, what it was like, what was going on, etc. So we'll just end with maybe one or two other questions about what we're discussing now. And sleep on that, you know. Go back into your Krishna conscious history and think about the times that you were, you know, most enthused, most excited, most determined, and what you were doing, what was happening in the environment.
Just in relation to what you were talking about, that the establishment of deep relationships or good association, as we call, implies that we develop a caring relationship with each other so that when we see somebody doing something wrong or in a dangerous situation or, you know, jeopardizing somehow their Krishna consciousness, we actually feel impelled to do something about it, just like a parent sees when their child is running into the street. You know, they may even yell at them or spank them in the bottom or whatever, but it's because there's a caring there. You know, you could get hit by a car. And so the offense of sadhu ninda, the Vaishnava aparad, that ninda means malicious intent, you know, so you have to watch out for malicious intent. But if the intent is caring and affectionate, then it may, you know, to an outsider, it may appear to be some kind of chastisement or whatever. But to the person with whom we have a loving exchange, hopefully it's something else. And it's really important in devotional service.
It's very important. And that's why it's so significant that, you know, devotees can relate to each other in this caring mood so that there can be more protection as we execute our devotional service. But there's a stronger and stronger, healthier community. Maya comes in less. People are able to rectify their issues a lot faster when they find themselves going off track, because the general environment is of such a way it gives them feedback, or they see others acting differently, and they begin to scrutinize closer what they're doing and why they're doing it. But when the patterns become so acculturated with so much weak devotion, mixed devotion, it's not only bad for the present devotees, but then when a new devotee comes, it becomes hard for the devotee to understand what is the standard. And they will be very confused. As we humble ourselves in association, Krishna will constantly come through to help us. And we do the opposite. Help will be there. We won't take advantage of it, even when it's right in our face. See, nobody just falls, really. I mean, it's just, we say accidental fall, yes, but Krishna gives so many warnings and so many ways to help us. You know, Maya is never stronger than righteousness, never stronger than Krishna. When Prabhupada was asked like that in New Vrindavan once, Krishna consciousness is the most natural thing, and why Maya is so strong. Because it seems like it's often easier to engage in the deviation. Prabhupada explained that it's not that Maya is so strong, but our desire to become Krishna conscious is so weak. We understand that because what we're constantly getting fed by material culture is inimical to devotion. We're really, you know, like a tribe in this universe, you know. And so, surrounded by all kind of disturbances. This is Maya's camp. Material world is basically designed so that people can engage in so many ways in how to forget Krishna. And then a few who start rising above that insanity, they're still surrounded with basic patterns for incarceration. This is Durga's abode. This is the abode for deviation, exploitation. And that's again, when we lose our enthusiasm, when we're not intense, then we'll fall back into the culture of exploitation. Okay, last question. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are those four states of mind also are they a reflection of some states of mind that are in the spiritual world, or in the spiritual world they just one state of mind, or what is it?
Asking you, these four states of mind are the reflections of states in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, people are not scattered. They're not conditioned. They're not having material bodies. They're not having minds that's being influenced by the material body or the material atmosphere. It's that last state we have on the other side, Turiya, or transcendental state. Because it's just the culture of bhakti, the culture of love. And that love is intoxicating. It's the high forever. It's just what this whole course is ultimately about. It's how to deal with getting rid of these relative and temporary and transitory things that we attach ourselves to that bring depression, setback, fall down, so that we can have the highest level of sense gratification. I mean, Krishna consciousness really, and I end with this, is really about how to acquire the highest eternal sense gratification. Because at this point, our senses are very limited, our minds are very dull in what we can experience. We're attuning ourselves into things that are, degrading for us. And so, with divine consciousness, I mean, the soul is Satchidananda Vigraha. It's eternal and it's full of bliss and it's enjoying, like anything, with so much knowledge. So that's the insanity that we really experience in material bodies. Then a different grades of that insanity that we're trying to discuss now. But the insanity is that here we can have the highest expressions of enjoyment. It's not that we're really following these rules and regulations to follow rules for the rest of our life. We're following these things to be freed of the shackles that have bound us so that we can be eternally in enjoyment. And when you think about that and you leave with this idea, for instance, when I said if we have to struggle for the rest of our lives in these bodies for what we can ultimately attain, it's worth it. But Maya wants us to think that it's really not worth it, so that we give in or backslide or deviate or bloop or whatever. So much of devotional service, once we have got this level of connection, like a perseverance test, and just minimize or stop making offenses. And then in this particular time, we're mostly under the category of Kripa Siddha. The three ways to go back to Godhead. Nitya Siddha, always thinking of the Lord, or those who have come, and then they go because they are eternally liberated. Or Sadhana Siddha, where we've done everything, so expertly we go through one state to the next state, to Prema, to full love of God. But in Kali Yuga, it's so hellish, This is one of the reasons that even some of the beings on higher planets want to come back and take birth during this time, because they know it's so difficult and it's so hellish that if you just do the basics, then you get a mercy far beyond other times. Lord Nityananda has guaranteed that. Lord Chaitanya, but especially Lord Nityananda. So that should help us also in being rid of some of the anxiety and depression of realizing that Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, they themselves are aware of just how hellish and how difficult it is in trying to be devotees in Kali Yuga. When, the environment is just so, so imposing. But if we can go on with not letting our minds come down to some of these things, then it becomes, as Sri Ramara said, it becomes our natural inheritance, dayabak. How does a son inherit his father's wealth? Just has to stay alive. So this kind of seminar that we're having is to help us in not dying down. Because we're going to find that in the material society, as well as in our own society, a lot of people are going to be dying in the coming years. Because the problems will get worse before they get better. Unless people have proper association and proper guidance and proper internal connection, they will become wounded, become casualties, and Maya will make people settle at different levels, and sometimes we will miss the chance. We have this wonderful opportunity to draw off our bank accounts. We will then close down the bank account for some time. So tomorrow, you think about the times you were most happy in Krishna consciousness. And since the next second half is going to be about forgiveness, you can also be thinking about things that you may be holding in, or people who you may have something against, some grudge that you haven't released. So those two meditations. Srila Prabhupada ki! Tomorrow is going to be a little short, I think 15, 20 minutes shorter. So we'll abbreviate a few things today. We have 1 day and 3 quarters left.